Hey there, this is Seth Wires from Channel 9 coming to you from the beautiful Studio D, which is an older building here at Microsoft, if you understand. I'm here with a special guest. Tell us who you are and what you do, bud.
I'm Ben Hillis. I'm a developer on the Windows subsystem for Linux team.
That's awesome. And we met like many years ago, didn't we?
Yeah, we went to school together at Utah. Go Utes.
Go Utes. They lost last week.
Yeah.
So I'm very upset. So tell us a little bit about what you're working on.
So Windows Subsystem for Linux is a essentially it's a binary compatibility layer for native Linux applications to run on the NT kernel, unmodified.
So when you say unmodified, you literally mean the same binaries that you would install on Linux work on Windows.
Right. We take our user mode is just a tarball that we take from the Ubuntu guys, and we just extract it. We don't modify it at all. It's literally the same binaries you would be running if you were running like a Docker container based on the same image.
And there's been a ton of videos, and we'll put some links below on how this actually works.
Right.
But you've been getting some feedback.
We have, yeah. So we announced at Build earlier this year, and then we were available maybe a couple weeks after that.
Sure.
And immediately we started getting lots of really good feedback from our users. We have a GitHub page that is very active, and a lot of bugs have come out of that. A lot of feature requests. Mm-hmm. We also have a user voice, which is nice because people can vote up or down. Right. They can say, "Oh, that sounds like a really good feature. I would like to see that," and then they can upvote. It didn't take long for one thing to kind of bubble to the top, and that was people saying, you know, Bash is great, but it's really just kind of Bash. I want to be able to run my Windows stuff inside of this shell. And that's what we're here to talk about today.
And that's an interesting problem because, I mean, given what we've learned about already,
right.
There's no like secret magic switch. It literally is Linux.
Right, exactly.
And so running a Windows application from inside of Linux, even though it's in Windows, is kind of a hard thing, right?
It is, and you know, Wine is an open source project from way back that did this. But we kind of have the benefit of we're already running Windows, right?
Yeah.
You're not in a VM with the Linux kernel. You're on a Windows machine, and there's other Windows processes on that machine. They just aren't visible to you normally. So in some ways it makes us able to provide something that you really can't do in a VM. Or a Docker container where you can run both Linux and Windows apps inside of the same environment.
So there's two levels that maybe we can talk about and you'll tell us how this works. The first level is running regular apps like VS Code or some other application.
Right.
But then like writing programs that can communicate between what's running in the Bash shell and outside of Windows.
Right, yeah. So for example, if you're deep in some path and you want to open, you know, a graphical text editor, say like Notepad or VS Code, the Windows version of VS Code. Using this new functionality, the current working directory will propagate along. You'll launch your Windows application, and it will appear just very similarly to if you were in CMD or PowerShell and typed VS Code. We want to give the same kind of experience,
which is super useful because the first time I wrote something is I wanted to make sure y'all were in line. I wrote some C printf thing, and then I did an object opt and saw indeed it was ELF, but I had to use Vim.
Right.
And I love Vim, but I mean, if you want to get a random string generated, you just put Vim in front of somebody and tell them to try to exit, right?
Exactly.
And so it's a little hard. It'd be nice to just say code dot.
Right. And I like Vim too, but I like gvim. You know, I don't like the console version of Vim. I like Vim, but also the all of the graphical, like, you know, visual copy paste and the menus and everything like that. So even if you like an editor like that, chances are you don't use the terminal version of those editors. You use the graphical version.
So there's a graphical version, but there's probably command line things as well, yeah?
Right, yeah. Even in the graphical version, like all the same command line stuff works inside of those, yeah.
All right, so let's get into how this actually works.
Right, so I think the first thing that I'll talk about is our IPC mechanism that I think we've talked about a few times kind of briefly before. We call it LXBus.
And IPC stands for Inter-Process Communication.
Right,
Yeah.
So LXBus is a socket-like communication protocol that essentially, you have an NT process on one side, and then you have a Linux or WSL process on the other side. And these are both user mode. So this is kind of the user mode boundary.
And again, just a reminder, there's other videos that show you how this actually gets instantiated. We'll make sure to put links on it.
Right. Right. So essentially what happens is that one side, very much like a Unix socket, registers a server with a name. So let's say the NT process says, "Oh, I want to create a server. The server name is foo." So he then listens, he opens up Foo, he waits for connections on Foo, and this guy knows that, he knows the name that he wants to connect to. So he says, oh, I want to open a connection to Foo. This is implemented as, well, this is implemented as an ioctl as well. So these go into the into our driver. Uh-huh. And so he's connecting. We look up Foo, say, oh, I know what that is. And then we return what we call a message port to both of these objects. So he'll get a, it's a file descriptor in WSL. It's a handle in NT. And then there's this communication channel established where they can read and write messages to each other, and they can do other things. They can share state, and that's how a lot of the that's how our IPC works. Is it's essentially this message-based protocol, and then that supports ioctls that allow you to share different things, whether it be memory or resources, handles.
I haven't heard the term ioctl. Is that like a memory space?
Ioctl stands for IO control code, I think.
Okay.
Something like that. And it's essentially, it's a type of operation that is handled in the kernel. Like a read is one other type, a write. Reads and writes only take, like they take a buffer and a size, right? And there isn't really any. The buffer can be anything, right? It can be a string. It can be contents of a file. And ioctl has a very set set input. So when you send an ioctl, there's a code, and you say this is ioctl 3, mm-hmm. and then the driver will know ioctl 3 means this is a register server ioctl. So I expect the buffer to contain a server name and maybe some other stuff.
It's almost like assembly, but for these particular processes.
Right. It's a way to make it's an extensible way to make calls into a kernel mode component is essentially what an ioctl is.
So let's see if I understand. We're completely at the process level right now.
Right.
So there's an NT process running. It's going to expose some kind of something service.
Right.
In WSL, if it wants to connect to it, it has to ask the kernel, "I want this." And it knows there's probably tons of other processes running over here. It says,
right.
Oh, this is the one,
right.
This is the handle, and then it does something here so that it knows that it can write into its memory space. Is that correct?
Right, so what happens is when you issue an ioctl to the kernel, you give it an input, or in the case of Windows, you could give it an input and then an output buffer. We use the same input-output buffer. So essentially, the kernel then has to make sure that that's like a valid address, has to protect against bug checks and stuff
sure.
like that. But it reads directly from that user memory, and then if it's input, it will, for example, the server name, it will say, this is this string. I'm going to register a server with this name, and then it will return a file descriptor that represents that server. That you then use another ioctl, the wait for connection ioctl, to wait for this guy to connect to you. Very much like sockets.
So effectively, and let's see if I'm understanding this right, what if, for example, this NT process is VS Code?
Okay.
And now I'm in WSL saying run VS Code.
Right.
How does this all sort of work together? Because VS Code isn't running, it's not registering a server.
Right. So the way that we do that is bash.exe registers the server. So when you launch a process, a WSL process through bash.exe, one thing that happens is as part of the registration, we create that server for you. And then bash.exe has a worker thread that waits for connections from its children to say, I want to launch this process.
I see. So this NT process in this case is bash.exe.
Right.
And you might be running multiple shells.
Right. So if you have multiple bash.exes open, the I call them the descendants of those, the WSL processes that are basically spawned from bash.exe, mm-hmm. not directly. It could be like 10 processes later through forks and execs, but they all have the same NT parent. So when you try to connect and launch a process, it'll have that same NT parent, and it'll have the same permissions. And you know, if you're running one bash elevated and you try to run regedit, it'll work. If you're running one bash unelevated and try to run regedit, it will not work because you can't run regedit unelevated in Windows.
And so let's see if I understand. If I'm running, let's just say I click on the Windows side, bash the bash for Windows. I click on it, one's running.
Right.
I click on another's running in administrator mode.
Right.
Those effectively are two different processes that register two different servers. And if you do forks inside of each one, then all of those sort of are registered to that server.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. And then when you're launching an NT process from within bash, it will go to the correct parent, and it will get the right permissions, basically.
And not only that, but it knows where to redirect the buffers to. Is that right?
Right. Yeah.
And because there might be a process I'm running inside of bash.exe that I put an ampersand, and so it's running in the background.
Right.
and there might be another one that I'm running, and it knows how to redirect everything to the right process.
Yeah, exactly. So that actually brings up an interesting point. So we mentioned graphical applications, and that's maybe the biggest request that we had was people saying, hey, I'm like 18 folders deep in my Mount C directory, and I want to open a text editor. I have to, you know, do I have to just open the text editor and manually navigate there? That sucks, you know?
Yeah, well, because it's kind of a long path.
It is. It's not great, you know, and we knew that, you know. But you can only do so much in your first release.
Sure.
So, but now, you know, if you're in Mount C, the current working directory will get propagated along, and then you can launch the application, and it's just as if you were in CMD and typed notepad.exe.
So this brings up another interesting point, and you tell me if this is beyond the scope, but
right.
Let's just say I write a regular NT process that's not bash.exe.
Okay.
Is there a way to register myself?
So we have a COM APIs. So this process, I kind of skipped over. It's really, bash.exe doesn't really talk to the driver directly. It talks to the service, and the service is kind of the arbiter between user mode, NT processes, and our driver. So there's this layer in between. We have a COM interface that we have not documented yet. Mm-hmm. We're still kind of looking into what it takes to document it. Do we want to document it yet? Because it's changing a lot.
Yeah.
We're still beta, and we're changing things quite a bit. And we don't want people to write code and have it be broken, the next time we release. So we're looking into it, but there could be some really cool things that you do with that.
Yeah.
But right now it's bash.exe.
So I like this setup. What does this sort of enable, sort of deep level sort of understanding?
Right. So let's say you're working on a cross-platform, some kind of application that you can compile for Linux and you can also compile for Windows.
Right.
Now you could launch a single bash.exe window, make your change, navigate to that directory, make changes with your favorite Windows text editor, save them, compile the Linux version, test it, make sure it works inside of the bash shell, and then without having to open up a different shell, you could invoke the Windows compiler and compile the NT version and run it and test it.
So you could effectively, like if you're DevOpsing some kind of .NET, because .NET Core now works on Linux, and
right.
Let's just say you wanted to work in Linux first to make sure that experience was good on Linux first,
right.
You could literally write a build script that will call to make the binaries in Linux and also make the binaries in Windows with the native Windows compiler.
Exactly. Oh. That's the goal.
That's
so
amazing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, so far, I'll put out some caveats. This is new. This will be coming to, by the time you guys are watching this video, this will be available in the Windows Insider builds. But like I said, it's new. And if there's things that you want, definitely put them on our user voice, our GitHub. We'll make sure there's links to both of those below. But yeah, one thing that has already come up from some internal testing is the Windows path variable. So you have both NT and Linux have a path,
yeah.
Right? And that'll be in Windows, it'll look like C, Windows.
And the other one's user.
And the other one's user, right. So right now, there's not any sharing between those. And really that's, we're looking into ways to share them better. To basically say, when you launch bash.exe, you will maybe inherit your Windows path.
See. So you're not having to put the whole path to a particular
right. Line. And bash lets you do some things to get around that. You can always add like an NT path into your Linux path variable, and that's fine. But it might be nice to kind of do that automatically for the users. So we're looking into that, and that might be coming. But we want to make sure that there's not any issues with that.
What an interesting sort of challenge now that you've literally sprouted two different worlds in the same OS, and the weird things that you would never think of, like, hey, I'm trying to run my Windows thing in bash and it's not running. Well, your path isn't set, which is an interesting thing.
Right.
What am I missing? Is there anything else that needs to be added to this?
Yeah, so there's a couple things. One is we mentioned graphical applications. Command line applications we also want to support.
Sure.
So, reg.exe is kind of a canonical example. No pun intended. So let's say you want to query your Windows registry and maybe see your build string. We'll have a demo coming up where we'll actually do this.
Let's do it.
But you'll be able to see the output inside of your bash shell as well. So reg.exe is a command line application. It writes to usually cmd.exe or PowerShell's screen buffer,
right.
Basically. And the like with this, we also will redirect the output from the NT process back into Bash.
And see, that's an interesting thing that I didn't even think of. When you're running CMD, for example, within Bash, it's going to be writing stuff to the screen. But you need to tell it how to put that back into the right screen.
Right, it needs a handle, right? Yeah. You need like when you so let's maybe do that a little bit. Okay. So I'll we've seen this. So I will mention that redirection is what we call it. IO redirection is what this is called. Works in both directions. So when we released initially, Bash.exe was kind of like an SSH terminal. Mm-hmm. You couldn't really pipe to or from it. You couldn't use it in like a long string of commands, right? So if you did bash.exe ls. So the C is kind of bash.exe's way of saying, just run this command.
Yeah.
I don't want this interactive. It would spit out this to whatever terminal you were running. But if you tried to then pipe it to FindStir or something, you would get an error. And that wasn't great because we wanted to let you use Bash inside of Windows scripts as well as use Windows apps inside of Bash scripts. So that's one, and you could also do.
So that works now with the new mechanisms.
Right. So and that will work in both directions. You could also go to like
a text
file. Yeah. So we support pipes. We support pipes as input and output for Bash.exe. We support files as input and output. You could also. This wouldn't really mean anything. So this means use this as standard in. LS wouldn't really do anything with that. But if you change this to grep, for example. Then you could, grep with some string, you could
see. And that would be the string of arena. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So let's talk about how that works.
Okay.
So that's kind of like, so first we'll talk about how that works for bash.exe. So you're inside of CMD or PowerShell.
Okay.
I want to run ls. Mm-hmm. And I want to pipe it out to a file. So you have bash.exe. And I'm going to kind of do this at a little bit higher level than I'll talk about all the different pieces, but this will be a little bit more high level. I'll dig in more in the blog. So bash.exe first launches, and let's say you did, this was the command line, bash-cls.
Okay.
So bash.exe will read the command line and say, okay, we're running -cls. Those are the arguments to be passed to bin bash. Which doesn't exist yet because it hasn't been created.
Right.
We'll just put the box there. So the first thing that happens is bash.exe constructs basically a message to send to the service over our COM interface, our create process COM interface. So now, actually, the service is in user mode, so sorry about that. So we have LXSS manager.
And that's always running, right?
Yeah. So LXSS manager is a trigger, MGR. Is a trigger started service, so it will run as long as there is a bash running somewhere on the system in some user's account. So we send a message to LXSS manager. He does some parsing, make sure that it's valid, and then he does what we call marshaling. Marshaling basically means we're taking something from one side, putting it in this kind of intermediate standby list, and then the other side takes it off of that list, and then it is able to use it. So
I see.
So when we're creating this process, Bash.exe is running out of CMD. It has three handles at least. So it has standard in, it has standard out, and it has standard error.
Right.
So the LXSS manager talks to LX core via ADSS bus ioctl or LX bus ioctls, uh-huh. Where it marshals these over. And when you marshal a handle or whatever you're marshaling, you get back an identifier that says it's a monotonically increasing number. So for example, the first thing you marshal will return 1, 2, et cetera. Then you use that number and send that you send that over LXBus to somebody on the other side, and then they use that to unmarshal. So let's roll back a little bit and I'll describe how better that happens.
Let's do it.
So we're doing our marshaling with the LXSS manager and the driver. We've done all our marshaling, we have everything ready, we're ready to create the process. We then send a create process message. And then inside of, as we've mentioned before, we have a daemon that is running inside of the instance. It's essentially, you can think of it as an analog to the manager service inside of the WSL instance. It's kind of the other endpoint. It's actually included as a binary resource in this file. And right now it's process one. It is the init daemon. Eventually we may move it to be a daemon, like netd or something. It doesn't necessarily need to be a knit. It could be its own thing. And anyway, so one of the first things that happens when you create an instance is this is an LXBus connection gets created here.
And this is all in user mode?
This is all user mode. Okay. So creating this connection requires some ioctls like we talked about before. But once this connection is established, it's a handle over here. It's a file descriptor over here. They do reads and writes. So we've done our marshalling with the driver. We now have a message that we want to send to a init, which includes those identifiers, those tokens, essentially, from the marshal operations. And then init reads this message, talks to LX core to unmarshal those.
Which is pulling the stuff that this process put down.
Right. There's a list in here that has those guys on there. He takes them off the list, creates a file descriptor that init can use, and then init sets the file descriptors that represent bash.exe standard in, out, and error, puts those as file descriptors 0, 1, and 2, and then calls exec, and we become bash.exe with the correct input and output from that is inherited from your NT parent.
And how does the piping out work? Is that just because it's the standard out has now been redirected?
Right. So when for example, if this was the only thing you ran, standard in would be console, standard out would be console, standard error would be console. If you add a pipe to the end of this, this means that standard out is now going to be a pipe to whoever is here. Let's say this is just Feinster, another NT process. Feinster. So when bash.exe launches, standard out will already be a pipe. So this is handled for you by CMD or PowerShell or whatever NT terminal you're running out of. So it works exactly the same way. It's just in this case, standard out will already be a pipe rather than a handle to a console.
And that standard out is being redirected to over here.
Right. It'll be marshaled the same way, and then init will receive it. And then when bash launches, it will be a file descriptor that represents this pipe to Feinster. So anything that bash would have written normally to mm-hmm. standard out is going to get Feinster is going to receive that as standard in.
I see. And so that way you're effectively running things, and it can you pipe the opposite way too, because that standard in would change.
Right.
Like, let's just say I did Feinster on some other thing and then piped it to bash.exe.
Exactly.
Then it would just change the file descriptor in to.
Okay. Exactly. So, and you can put a bunch of these together. We'll show you in the demo later how you can incorporate bash.exe-c into a really long a long Windows
pipe.
Command and get output. So you could intermix different commands, and that's kind of the goal. And it's been working really well. Like I think that. You know, we have very like 1,000-level view of the way people are going to use this, and we have like ideas of what people are going to do. They could do some really cool scripting with this, right? We're not the scripters. Like we're the kernel guys. Like we know that our users are going to do things that we've never thought of with this.
So go out and break it.
And go, yeah, go break it, but go use it. And if it doesn't work the way you want it to, let us know. You know, so.
So is there anything we're missing before we actually look at how this works on a computer?
Right. So the other part we're missing is the other way around. So let's say you're in, and so it's very similar, and it was designed to be very similar to make it doesn't make sense if you do it one way if you're launching an NT process and the other way if you're launching a Linux process. So I guess I don't need to draw another thing. But let's say this is going the other direction. I'll just kind of remove these lines because all of the same players are kind of in play, except for this connection. So as we mentioned before, when bash.exe launches a process, we register a server here that is kind of a worker thread that's waiting for create process requests, right? So bin bash has a connect. This bin bash has a file descriptor to this guy.
Okay.
So he does a very similar thing that happened between bash.exe and the LXSS manager, except in this case we don't go through init. We go directly to the kernel to do the marshalling. And via ioctls on LXBus ioctls, and then we send a message directly to our parent bash.exe.
And the ioctl is just saying, here's the memory that I want you to, that's being marshaled?
Mostly the file descriptors. Okay. So bash.exe, you'll have 0, 1, and 2. The file descriptors, 0 is in, 1 is out, 2 is error. So in order for the Windows process to be reading and writing from the right files, we marshal them over. So then bash.exe reads the message. unmarshals and gets NT handles. And then the create process API, you can look it up on MSDN, it allows you to specify your standard in, out, and error as handles to the create process API.
I see.
So it's a little different than in Linux, where you exec and you just kind of inherit 1, 0, 1, and 2. In NT, you can be more explicit and say, this is the handle I want to use as standard in, and it's this pipe. So for us, we created this new NT handle type that represents any file object inside of the Linux instance. So you have, let's say you have, you're inside of bash, and you have a command string that looks like ls piped to, let's just say finster, and then you want to look for foo. So finster will go, finster will get created by bash.exe, right? But when it gets created, we need this
standard in.
This file descriptor that represents standard in to be finster's, or standard out to be finster's standard in
yeah.
For this to be able to work. So,
and that's you're inside of the of bash, you're inside of Linux user mode,
right.
Calling ls, piping to a Windows process that hasn't been started yet.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. So one other thing before we go to the demo that I want to mention is that kind of the nitty gritty, how, like, this is kind of glossing over some stuff. How do you actually launch Finster? Like, is it, I mentioned it isn't in the path, so how does this work? So Linux actually has a capability called bin format that allows you to essentially register file types with an interpreter that knows how to handle them. So some examples are Python has a bin format interpreter for compiled Python files, so you can run them directly without having to say, like, Python foo. You can just exec foo. And then the way bin format works is it's this registration-based system. You give it an input string, so I'll kind of write an example.
Let's do it.
So I am, you know, I'm a Windows guy. I implemented this, but I'm going to maybe get some things a little, like, maybe this format won't be perfect, but you'll get the idea. So it's kind of this colon-separated string. There's a name. There's a type. There's a offset. And then there is a, this is a magic byte array. And then there's, I think, some flags after that, or there's a bit mask. But so the rest of them don't really matter too much. So these are kind of the most important ones. So the name is just going to be the name that appears inside of proc sys fs bin format. There's this file system that gets mounted that we've implemented. And then name, if you create a, you know, if this was a registration name, then there would be this file called name that you can read and you can see information about this. Type is either, there's two different ways you can do this. File extension, which is going to sound more familiar to Windows guys. So you could register something with, like, .exe or .cmd. Mm-hmm. So you could say, the last thing that's important here is the interpreter. So we'll mention that in a second. So essentially what that means is I have this program that knows how to handle this file type.
I see. And you're doing that inside of Linux. So the finster is going to look in this bin format miscellaneous for the finster and then know how to execute.
Right, so actually the kernel is going to do this. User mode registers this, but then as part of the exec system call, the kernel looks up all of the registered bin format extensions and says, oh, this is the special file type that I know how to handle, so I'm going to invoke that interpreter. So the way that looks is you do exec.
Which is a system call.
Is a system call. And let's just pretend it only has one argument for now. Let's say it's foo, or let's do finster. Finster.exe. So exec will, we've registered a bin format, let's assume we've registered a bin format that handles .exe files. Exec reads the file name, says, oh, there's .exe. I know that I have this interpreter that knows how to run this. So what it does is then takes that interpreter. In our case, init is our interpreter. So it's a binary that we've written. We decided to just use the same one again, rather than have to, you know, put more things into the Ubuntu user space. Exec then basically shifts the arguments all one to the right, and then so argument one becomes .exe, and then we look up init. Init is a regular ELF binary, and then init will get launched with this command line. So then init is our binary. When it's run as process one, it's running as like a daemon. So we're handling the process launches, we're communicating with the service. When it's launched as any other process, so in this case it will not be process ID one, we know that it is this bin format interpreter mode, and then
so
we
look up this.
So this has been looked up by the kernel, but it gets this command line and it says, oh, I know that means this user wants to run finster.exe. So then it creates a message, does the marshaling we described, sends that message to bash.exe, and then finster is launched.
I see, and that's through the exec system call.
Right.
That has all of these things loaded.
Right, so it's cool. We've had users actually, they wanted this so much that they wrote their own kind of version of this. And one benefit of this is that you can since we control the kernel, right, the exec system call natively handles this. You don't have to say, you don't have to provide some kind of launcher command before the Windows process you want to launch, because the kernel will do that for you automatically.
Well, this is awesome. I feel like we need to look at some stuff.
Yeah, now. Command line stuff makes much more sense when you actually see it. Like, so we'll get into the demo.
All right, let's have a look.
Cool.
All right, Ben. So we looked at everything on the board, and I thought maybe it would be a lot easier to just actually see what's happening.
Right. So let's launch CMD, and we can go into a directory that I've prepared. And we can see that there is a folder. There are a couple files in here. If you want to run bash commands, the way you do that is bash.exe-c, so we can do an ls, which will be a directory listing.
Okay.
All this worked in the anniversary update, so let's show some stuff that didn't work. So let's do that dir, and then use grep to look for some specific strings in there. I see the string dir a couple times. So we'll see that the output of dir was filtered by line for strings that contain dir.
And so just to remember, like, what is the process that this is working? Because they're obviously in different worlds, in different user modes. Can you remind us of sort of the process, like what's happening?
Right. So dir is being run. That vertical line is the pipe operator. That means that the output of dir should go to the input of bash.exe.
Got it.
So essentially, bash.exe reads, instead of reading from the console, they'll be reading from the output of dir, which contains that text.
And so bash.exe is actually running the whole bash shell and spinning up the user mode, and then it's communicating via that stuff that we talked about.
Right. Yeah, and then it launches grep, and grep does the filtering. So you could do it the other way. If you wanted to do an ls and filter that to finster, which is essentially the Windows version of grep, and look for dir, you'll see, there are no dirs in there, so let's look for index, because that's the file. So we'll see it has that. Has the one file named index shows up in there. So
when you're running bash.exe, it's running in the context of the current directory now.
Correct, okay. Yeah. So you'll see if you just launch bash.exe, the current working directory gets propagated along. So you'll see
that's nice.
C colon my alias turns into mount C Ben Hill.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go the other way. Now that we're in the bash shell and we want to run a Windows command. So, of course, we can do ls like we just did. We can pipe inside of the bash shell and find index again. But let's run a Windows command. So we'll do cmd.exe, and we'll see, oh, that's not found. That's because it's not in the path. So we're going to set this to the path. This is just a regular old Linux command. CMD is in Windows System 32, and now we'll see cmd.exe will run. So now we're running CMD again.
From within
bash. And then we do a dir, and you'll see the same contents we saw before. So let's exit out of that and just run an individual command. cmd.exe whack c means run this command, and we'll do dir. And now we can pipe this to grep and look for that dir string. We could pipe that to another Windows command if we want. Let's do finster. And let's look for, I see that word folder. And now we should only see that third line. So
I mean, this is kind of like, I know you're like, oh, this is really simple stuff. But when you understand what's going on in the background, these processes are running really independently of each other. They're not, they don't know about each other. In fact, their makeup is completely different.
Right, and you're sharing file objects between Windows and Linux, or WSL, which is essentially the hard part of this. So each of these pipes has to be, you know, visible on both sides, so the Windows apps and the Linux apps can read it. So for example, you see like grep there in the middle. It's reading from that cmd.exe wacdir, and then it's writing to another Windows file.
Or Windows command.
Windows command. We mentioned the handle marshalling. That's how that happens under the covers.
Okay.
So the Windows processes that get launched get handles that represent files inside of the WSL instance.
So remind me, because you did something with the path, remind me how it knows. Because when it's in the Linux context, usually
right.
there's like a chmod plus x so that it knows to execute. How does
right.
it know the Windows executables?
Well, that's a good. Well, so that's the bin format thing that we talked about.
Okay.
I'll show you the path. These are all the folders that are in a path. You'll see system32 at the end. And then, you know, if we run notepad.exe, we'll see that, notepad pops up. The way that works is Linux is doing the path parsing. So it goes in order. It says, is there a notepad.exe here? No. Is there a notepad.exe here? No. For everyone, finally it gets to this one, and there is a notepad.exe in here. This is Bash doing this inside of Linux user mode. It's looking for a file that matches this file name. So when it finds that file name, it's able to run it by the bin format extension. So if we go to proc sysfs bin format, and then do a list in here. Here, I'll do it so we can see it at the top. We'll see there's a register and a status file. Those are just ways to register and see the status of the bin format extensions. And then there's one called WSL interop, which is, you'll see this says init knows how to handle this magic number, which this is the first two bytes of a Windows PE executable are MZ, and 4D is the hex character for M, 5A is the hex character for Z.
And those are the first sort of bytes that are in any executable file in Windows.
Right. So to kind of refresh, Linux user mode does the path lookup. It finds notepad.exe. It then says, I found a file. I'll call the exec system call. Then in the driver, we use these bin format registrations and see if there's one that matches the file type that we get from user mode.
It makes more sense now that I'm actually seeing it, because you call init or exec, or what is it? What is this init doing?
Right. So what it would look like is, Bash is doing the path lookup, right? Once it finds a file that matches, it would look kind of like exec mount c windows system32 notepad.exe.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this is the part that gets passed up to the kernel, and then there's a lookup in the exec system call, opens this file, reads the first couple bytes out of it, and then looks through each of these registered bin format interpreters and finds one that matches. And then essentially what that does, it doesn't go back to user mode, but internally in the kernel, it will shift everything. So the notepad.exe essentially becomes the second argument, and then the interpreter becomes the first argument. So then init gets launched, and then init knows how to handle NT binary, so then it can open this file and do the right thing to make it launch.
And then a new process that's an NT process.
Right, and then the NT process comes up, yeah. So
that's pretty cool.
Thanks. So let's see if there's anything else. Yeah, we showed this, I showed this briefly, but this was one of the main asks that we got from people, was to be able to just run Notepad or your favorite text editor and be able to modify files. So we know that Notepad's still in the path, so we can do Notepad, and I know there's a file called index in this folder, which is just kind of I think this is Bing.com's homepage source. So you'll see that you can edit it. Let's say I want to replace it, save it, and then we'll see, we can just print the contents of this file. And you'll see empty, because I didn't do a null terminator. It's essentially people can now launch their editor, with the current working directory propagating along, edit their files in their favorite Windows graphical editor, save the contents, and then keep working inside of Bash.
So now, is it as simple as when you're calling the exec and it's doing the init, it's passing the second as an argument to the actual executable?
Right. So we don't do any munging with the arguments. We pass them as is. So right. Yeah. So if we do notepad.exe index, then it'll find this file, right? Because that's a relative path. If we did notepad.exe /benhill mm-hmm. index.html, which happens to be the NT path for this, have to do multiple slashes because
that's right, because
it's an escape character. Then it will still find the same file because we just pass it without doing any kind of translation.
Got it.
So relative paths kind of will work out. If you're passing absolute paths, it'll have to be the Windows path because we don't do any kind of translation there.
That's pretty cool. And you're doing this all from Linux user mode.
Right.
Okay. What else do you have?
Let's see. So why is this useful? For example, we'll see inside of here, I have this query.sh script, which we can, let's take a look at in Notepad. We'll see it's calling cmd.exe waxc reg query. It's basically looking at the build version of the Windows build that we're running. So we run that script and we get the build lab comes
nice.
Out. So we're running reg.exe to query the registry from within Bash. And then, like we showed before, you could then use grep to see, let's look for the word build. You could then use your favorite Linux commands to filter or incorporate it into a batch script.
And it's awesome because you could pipe forward as much as you want. What about piping backward?
Right. So that works also. So let's write the contents of this out to a text file. Let's just call it out.txt. And then we do grep, look for build again, piped in, out.txt, and we get the same thing. So the caret pointing towards the left means use this file as input. The caret going to the right means use this file as output. So this way we first wrote the contents to out.txt, and then we piped them redirected it to grep and searched for the build string.
This is pretty cool. Does this work? Because right now you're doing grep build, and which is a Linux process inside of Linux.
Right.
And then in piping a file, which is inside of the can you mix and match?
Right. So let's say we want to do Feinster instead. Look for build, pipe, and then we'll see the same contents. We won't see the highlighting because Feinster doesn't do that. But yeah, so essentially this launched cmd.exe, the Feinster command, waxc means run this command and exit, Feinster for build, and then read out a standard in the file that we created, and we get the same output.
That's pretty amazing. Now, tell us again, because I know you mentioned this, but I want to make sure we emphasize this. Why is this such a cool thing for people?
Well, this is something that, frankly, you can't do on a Linux VM. A lot of the power of being a subsystem that's running within Windows on the same kernel with the same file system is the potential to do things like this, to be able to mix and match Windows and Linux commands. Have multi-platform build systems. You could build and test the Linux version of your project, and then build and test the Windows version of your project, all from the same shell.
It's pretty amazing because you effectively, if you have the right path and
right.
you're doing a build, they say you want to have a binary that's an ELF64 and then another one that works with Windows. Mm-hmm. In your build script, you can call the right command from the right OS. Build the right binaries and test them all in the same run without having to go into a VM and then go over here and go over there.
Right.
That's pretty impressive. Right. How many people asked for this? I bet there was a lot.
Yeah, so this was our number one request on user voice. There were a few kind of duplicate entries on there. So if you added them all up, there were maybe a few hundred upvotes for this particular feature. Mm-hmm. That's what when we did our planning for the build that will be coming after the anniversary update, we wanted to give the people what they want. And what better than to knock off the top things on the list?
This is pretty amazing. Because I mean, like I build an open source library with .NET Core,
mm-hmm.
and I want it to work everywhere.
Right.
And if it works on Linux, it'll work on a Mac as far as I can tell. And so now I can create builds in one place that run seamlessly for everything.
Right.
Which is super nice, and then make sure the tests run and everything. This is really cool. All right, so we saw how this actually works on a computer. We saw how it works on the board. Any final words, or where can people go to find out more?
Well, to find out more, I would suggest looking at some of our other blog posts. There's some great ones. There will be more coming. I suspect we'll do another one on LX Bus in more detail, since we just kind of glossed over that, and it actually does a lot more than what we talked about. I would, if you find issues with this or have feature requests, our user voice is a great resource, and our GitHub is, if you have a bug, our GitHub is the best place to go.
Well, this is awesome. Go forth and try. Yeah. It's pretty exciting. We've been learning all about how to do inter-process type stuff on Windows Subsystem for Linux. My name is Seth Juarez, Channel 9. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.